You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Greenbelt, please join me in welcoming Brian McLaren.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm so happy that you showed up. I was reminded this is my seventh Greenbelt, and I was reminded of my very first Greenbelt when I arrived and I was ready for my talk, and then all the electricity went out. And someone handed me a bullhorn. Peter, who might be here, handed me a bullhorn, and so I used that to give my very first talk. And then this Greenbelt, we've had some wind, and I wasn't able to give the talk that I had planned for that session. And then today we have rain. We have another bit of an electrical problem earlier. But here you all are, and we're going to have a good time together. I'm going to take the talk that I was going to give the other day and what I was going to give today, and I've mashed them together. And so hopefully this will be helpful to all of you. There's a story that I have heard in many different versions. Maybe you've heard it too. It's often told as a Buddhist story, a Chinese folk tale, and it goes like this. There was an old farmer who used to sit outside of his home every afternoon and watch the sunset. And one day, as he was watching the sunset, his neighbors came running in, and they said, "We have amazing good news. Your son was out in the forest, and he found a beautiful stallion, a strong, healthy stallion, and he managed to capture it, and he's bringing it back now. There he comes." And they said to this old farmer, "Isn't this good fortune that your son has found this stallion?" And the old farmer said, "Maybe it's good, maybe it's not." Well, the next day, as the farmer was sitting watching the sunset, his neighbors came running. And they said, "Your son was out training his new stallion, and the stallion reared back. He fell off and has broken his leg. It is such bad fortune that he found that stallion. It's such bad luck that he fell off. We're so sorry." And the old farmer said, "Maybe it's bad. Maybe it's not." And the next day, he was sitting at sunset watching the beautiful colors of the clouds, and a group of soldiers came running in, and they said, "We're here to collect all of the young men from this village and make them soldiers for the emperor. Where is your son?" And he pointed to his son lying on a bed, unable to move. And the soldier said, "Well, he's no good to us." And so they took the horse and they left. And the neighbors said to the old farmer, "Your old son was spared from military service because of the broken leg. You'll still have him here to help you in your old age. Isn't this good?" And you know what the farmer said? "Maybe it's good, maybe it's not." And this is one of those stories that never ends. It can go on and on and on. And I wanted to tell that story because I'm about to share some thoughts with you. And part of your brain has been so trained to always respond to anything that comes up by trying to decide if it's good or it's bad. And so what I'd like to invite you to do is try to intentionally restrain that kind of dualistic judgment for a few minutes. It's not to say things aren't good or bad. It's to say that what looks bad could have good outcomes, and what looks good could have bad outcomes. And sometimes the simple reaction and judgment of good or bad is not the most helpful reaction to have. So could I sort of get an agreement from you? You will try to restrain that. If you can succeed, I think we'll be able to go farther in this time together than we could otherwise. Like a lot of you, I was raised a Christian, And my understanding of Christianity was that it was primarily an evacuation plan. The earth was hopeless, and we were trying to evacuate as many people as we could to the lifeboat and then get them to heaven for eternity after time is done. And I believed that. I preached that for many years. And then I went through a transition in my thinking. This happened in large part because I was a preacher. And as a preacher, I actually had to open the Bible many times per week. And I was trained to look at certain verses and skip over a lot of others. But when I looked at the ones I was skipping over, I started to realize some things. I started to realize, for example, that the Jewish people in all of the Hebrew scriptures, they didn't believe in heaven and hell. Now, if you read the King James Version, you might think that because it had some very bad translations. For example, of the Hebrew word Sheol, which just means the grave or the place of the dead, they translated that as hell because they were translating it into their Christian theological categories. But I started to realize that, for example, when we pray the Lord's Prayer, we do not pray, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. When we die, may we go to your kingdom where your will is done, unlike here on earth." But rather we prayed for God's kingdom to come here on earth, for God's will to be done here on earth. And I started to realize that the focus of the scriptures was not after this life, outside of the earth and in history. It was about this earth, and it was about this life. And to the degree we talk about afterlife, it's to give us courage and strength to live wisely and well and with love and generosity in this life. And that raised a question for me in about 2006, 2007. I thought, if God's concern and if Jesus' concern is about the well-being of this earth, it's not just trying to extract our souls like candy from a wrapper and take them up to heaven, but rather God really is concerned about these beautiful, amazing trees that have been preserved here for hundreds of years, and about the weather systems in the earth that brought us this rain today, but that it's maybe a little bit inconvenient, but it's part of living on a planet that has beautiful, amazing, balanced weather systems. If God cares about this earth, what's going on in the earth? What are the biggest problems in the earth? And I wrote a book called Everything Must Change. It was a book I started off with a question, not answers. And one way to say my inciting question was, what are the biggest problems in the world? Now look, if you're a doctor, you'll probably think that medical problems are the biggest problems in the world. And if you're an artist, you'll probably think bad television is your biggest problem in the world. Whatever your background is, you'll notice problems relating to your background. If you're religious, it might be bad doctrines or, whatever. I wanted to try to understand the big picture. And it was really one of the most important writing projects I ever took on. It changed me as a human being in the writing of this book. And after I immersed myself in the literature, which might sound quite depressing, but it was actually exhilarating. I felt like finally, in my 50s, I'm beginning to ask the question that I think somebody should have told me very early on, what are our biggest problems? What do we have to deal with here in this world? I finally came away with something that gave me some sense of what was going on. And in my research, I saw three significant problems. This is back in 2006, 2007. And the first was the problem of our relationship with the planet. Second was our problem of poverty and wealth inequality. If I were writing the book today, I would talk about it not just being an inequality of wealth, but an inequality of power. Because what we've realized what I've realized, and many of you may have known this all along, but the problem of wealth inequality is that the wealthiest people, the hyper wealthy people, what they do with their wealth is they tend to buy two things. They buy politicians and they buy media. They buy politicians so they can ensure those politicians will help them to maintain and grow their wealth and power. And they buy media so that they can influence public opinion, so that public opinion will also vote for politicians and support policies that protect their own wealth and power. And so the first problem is our relationship with the planet. Our second problem is this inequality of power and wealth. And the third problem was the dissemination of weapons. If you want alliteration, it's planet, poverty and power, and peace. Because when one of the things we find that those with power do is they make sure there's as many weapons around as possible so they can keep people turning on each other, nations turning on each other, races turning on each other, religions turning on each other. And this accumulation of weapons at all levels, in some countries worse than others, I know this because of where I live. We spread individual weapons wherever we can. And in some countries, they amass weapons of mass destruction, something I know about in my country as well. So that now, you know, since the 60s and 70s, we have the power, nuclear weapons, to just blow everything up and end everything we built. In the name of peace, we plan our own destruction. And so those three problems I've been thinking about all of these years. But what's happened in the last few years is the issue of climate change, it seems, has turbocharged our concern about global problems. And so a few years ago, I proposed to one of my editors that I wanted to write a book, and then after that, I wanted to write a book that I would call Life After Doom. And I wanted to go back and look at global problems and see how things had changed and see how my thinking would change. And this editor said to me, "I'm sorry, you've got to write Life After Doom first, because it's the book I want to read. And it's the book my whole staff wants to read, because we have this feeling that things are getting out of control. And we're waking up with a sense of dread every day." So I ended up planning to publish this book in 2025. But last summer, I'd finished an early draft, and I sent it to my editor. This is my American editor, and said, "Here's a first draft. This book is 20,000 words longer than I want it to be, but I can't figure out what to cut. Could you decide what to cut, and then I'll work on it for the next year?" And then it was going to come out. I would turn it in this year, it would come out next year. This was the last week of June, first week of July last year, and that was the week we reached a temperature higher than we believe had ever been achieved, a global average temperature in at least 135,000 years, and maybe a million and a quarter years, and maybe even longer than that. And then there were huge fires in North America, across Canada and the American West, and those fires created this big cloud of orange smoke that drifted across the nation. And my editor lived in New York City, and New York had this sort of orange glow. You may understand why many Americans have been traumatized by the color orange in recent years. But this smoky, days of a smoky sky had an apocalyptic feel, and my editor emailed me and said, "I can't cut 20,000 words, and I don't think we should wait a year. I think we should get this book out as soon as possible. Because," she said, "this book," you know, she reads a lot of books. She said, "this book made me cry, mostly in a good way. But," she said, "I feel we need to grapple with these issues now." And one of the things that really happened to me in the writing of this book is that I realized that the people who are most deeply engaged with the issue of climate change, and thank God for all the scientists who are doing research in so many different areas, you know, studying the water that's undermining one part of one ice sheet in Greenland or in Antarctica, people who are studying minute changes in the acidification of our oceans or of a particular coral reef. So much research is being done, and it's all so important, and we should be so grateful for every scientist who's doing their work, and then every journalist who tries to understand and accurately represent their work. We're all dependent on each other and on these people. But the people who are trying to understand the big picture and put it all together, what I came to realize is their greatest fear is that long before the environment tips into deadly levels of disruption, that human civilization will tip into dangerous levels of deterioration. And so what I'd like to talk to you about in our time together now is I'd like to talk about why worlds fall apart. And when I say worlds, I don't just mean physical worlds. I mean conceptual worlds, economic worlds, political worlds, artistic, creative worlds. Why civilizations themselves seem to have an expiration date. And what goes wrong with civilizations? And in order to do that, I think the most efficient way is for me to read just a few paragraphs from this book, Life After Doom, and then I'll explain where that takes us. Because I'd like to talk about why worlds fall apart and how worlds fall apart, but I'd also like to talk about how new worlds get born. The process of civilizational collapse has been studied in depth by historians, leading among them Joseph Tainter. In simplest terms, Tainter says, complex societies collapse when their key institutions can no longer solve the civilization's problems. He gives over a dozen historic examples and focuses in depth on three: the Western Roman Empire in Europe, the Mayan society in Central America, and the Chaco society of the American Southwest Desert. Each civilization faced problems. When it overcame those problems, it grew. Its growth created new problems that it would overcome, leading to new growth. However, each solution required new levels of complexity, infrastructure, and bureaucracy, which were increasingly expensive to maintain. Eventually, the cost of maintaining existing complexity, infrastructure, and bureaucracy would be so great that the civilization could not afford to solve new problems when they arose. The growth curve would peak and decline would follow. The Roman Empire, Tainter explains, was especially effective in solving problems. And what I'm about to explain is really what we call colonialism. Colonialism results from a series of successes for one society that become destruction for other societies. This is why I asked you to try to refrain from thinking, oh, this is good, this is bad. Rome's growing agricultural output led to population growth. And eventually, the rising population needed even more food. The solution? Rome invaded neighboring countries, colonizing them and exploiting their land, labor in the form of slaves and vassals, agricultural output, and other resources such as precious metals, art, and knowledge. Maintaining these colonial holdings, however, proved expensive for Rome, requiring ever-growing numbers of soldiers, garrisons, communication and administrative systems. This infrastructure required ever-increasing taxes. High taxation often led to internal corruption, as the upper classes skimmed tax money for personal luxuries while the masses struggled for basic necessities. Higher taxes, corruption, and growing economic inequality led to increasing levels of social unrest, which required more domestic military policing and tighter social control, which were also increasingly expensive. Eventually, a shortage of soldiers required the empire to hire mercenaries who lacked loyalty to the regime. As a result, the cost of the military increased while its effectiveness declined. The spiraling cost of maintaining the Roman Empire at its peak level of complexity became too high and it began to falter. The collapse was hastened by fragmentation, invasion, looting by outsiders, insurrection, and rebellion among insiders, leading to a declining population. Past collapses have sometimes unfolded quickly, but often the process has been agonizingly slow, depending on a variety of internal and external factors. How much damage is the civilization doing to its environment and its energy sources, eroding or degrading its precious topsoil, cutting down its trees, depleting its groundwaters, polluting its waters? How much is it exploiting and oppressing the poor and middle classes and distributing wealth, disproportionate wealth and power to those who need it least? How much is the society spending on its military and policing? And what is its return on military investment? Socially, how deeply is the society's morale and shared identity being weakened by internal greed, decadence, corruption, distrust, resentment, and conflict? Is the civilization being further weakened by insurrections, coups, civil wars, mass migrations, financial crises, attacks and invasions, pandemics and plagues, climate change, and declining physical or mental health? And so that was what I learned, a summary of what I learned from the literature on what happens to societies. And one of the things that struck me in this study, especially applying it to contemporary societies, is that when a society's unable to solve its problems the way it used to, social disorder and social resentment and social division intensifies and people turn on each other. And I don't know if you ever thought of this before, but when people turn on each other, that is an energy source. One of the most powerful social energy sources is resentment and fear and hate and love. And there is a certain kind of entity that arises that feeds on the energy source of resentment and fear and hate and love. It's called authoritarianism. Authoritarians are masters at sucking in the energy of resentment and sucking in the energy of fear and processing it into hate for some people and love for other people. And they use that to amass power to themselves. Now, you can imagine, because of where I live, I'm especially sensitive to this ability of certain people to suck in resentment and process it into an energy source or power for themselves. But this is not just happening in one country. This is happening in many places around the world because many of our societies are not able to solve the problems that they used to solve. And a certain kind of growing resentment becomes an inevitable source of energy for people who know how to manipulate it. Now, there are other people who know how to elicit hope and commitment and courage and wisdom and collaboration, and that creates a different kind of leadership. But suddenly it struck me that the situation that we're in our world is a situation where if we aren't careful, we can become sucked into these dynamics of resentment and fear and hate. And by the way, you understand, hate and love aren't simply opposites. Very often, when people love something and other people harm it, that's what teaches them to hate. It's the passion of love that often can be transmitted into the passion of hate. And so I started to feel that we're in this dynamic situation. Now, I was a minister for 24 years. I've been a committed Christian since I had a very powerful spiritual experience as a teenager. But I'm among people who are deeply disappointed in our religious communities. I'm disappointed in Christianity, what's happened to our institutions, and what's happened among many of these different movements within Christianity. They've been sucked into authoritarianism, or they've been lulled into complacency at a time we really need them. But I think of my dear Jewish friends, rabbis, who are watching what's happening in Israel, and they feel that the very heart of what Judaism stands for is being corrupted by people in the name of Judaism. And I have Muslim friends. I think of what was happening in the early part of this century when there was wave after wave of terrorism and violence by Muslims, most of it directed against their fellow Muslims. And I remember a Muslim leader in the United States saying, "Never in Muslim history have Muslims succeeded in making our beautiful religion as ugly as it is now." I felt Christians could say that, Jews could say that, Buddhists and Hindus are having their own versions of this. And then I realized, but it's not just religion. This is happening in politics. It's happening across our institutions. And I started to look at our problems less as problems of governments or religions or nations, and more as a problem of our human species. That we as human beings have these repeated patterns of building civilizations that then reach a point of decay, and then we repeat the cycle again and again. And we human beings now are at this amazingly significant moment, because we not only have built three or four major civilizations around the world, but now these civilizations have linked up and formed one massive global economy, one massive global communications infrastructure. And there have been enormous benefits from this. Remember, maybe it's good, maybe it's not. If we can stop thinking in those terms, we can just start to see what is and say, this is the world that we're in. And I started to realize, as many people have, that now we aren't just dealing with a civilization that might have its rise and fall, but we have a global civilization. And we've all heard that phrase, too big to fail. And we wonder if we've created a civilization that's simultaneously too big to fail and too big to survive. And so I think many of us are waking up with this anxiety day after day. It's the feeling that our problems are bigger than our institutions and our traditional solutions to solve them. When I say in the title of this book, Life After Doom, by doom I don't mean some apocalyptic nightmare scenario, but what I mean is the feeling that we wake up with, where we feel like, here's how I feel very often. I feel like if I were to know more about this situation, I would be even more upset. So I've got to keep at bay, sort of keep myself at my current level of understanding, because I don't want to get more overwhelmed. And when in the writing of this book, what I felt I had to do is sort of jump into the deep end of the pool and see if I could swim to the bottom, and wondered if I would come up or not make it up. I did make it up, but I didn't make it up with my old thinking intact, and I didn't make it up with some of my old idealism intact. People often ask me, well, do you have hope? Probably the most difficult chapter in this book to write is called Hope is Complicated. I came to realize that hope is an immeasurably valuable feature of a human being. I have a friend who's a clinical psychologist. He spent his career studying hope, and he just says, look, if you want to give people a secret for success, it's hope. And if you take it away from them, things fall apart for people. We desperately need hope, but hope can also be a real problem, because if what hope gives us is this feeling that as soon as I can hear one or two anecdotes of good things happening, I say, oh good, I don't have to worry about it. I can return to my previously scheduled complacency. The irony is that kind of hope can give people a sense of complacency that makes the things they hope for less likely. Do you see that? But at the same time, if we lose hope and we have despair, guess what happens? We say, well, there's nothing I can do. It's hopeless. And we return to our previously scheduled complacency. And so what I see people like us as we awaken to the challenges of the reality, the challenges of our world, that we have to find a way to not be overwhelmed by overwhelm. We have to find a way to be realistic and to not sugarcoat things. But we have to find a way to not let the worst possibilities paralyze us. And so that was sort of the project I had in this book. I should say, one of the kind of fun little things I stepped into was there is a theory. I'm sure a lot of you have encountered this theory, whether you're physicists or astrophysicists, because this theory is used in relation to star formation and galaxy formation, or if you're in biological sciences or earth sciences. There is this thing called the adaptive cycle. In my invisible PowerPoint here, I'm going to draw it for you. It's an infinity loop, and it begins by going up and then going down. And then if you know how that Möbius strip works, the down then comes back and then creates the conditions for a new going up. And it's a cycle that goes in that kind of infinity shape. And the cycle works like this. Whenever something begins, it requires energy. Whether it's a star, there has to be a certain amount of energy in the form of matter around and gravity that pulls that matter together and then creates a star that then becomes a source of energy. But there has to be an energy source. So they call the first phase of this in the sciences, and they're not speaking sociologically or economically, but they use the word the exploitation phase. An energy source is available, and some new arrangement comes together to exploit that energy source. And then that project gets to a place where it can no longer, it's using the available energy, and it tries to conserve the level of complexity that it has reached. When you look at those beautiful, huge trees that surround us, of course, this is a very managed place, but we all know that there's something called a climax forest. The climax forest develops, and it can hold on to the beauty of a climax forest for 200, 400, 800, sometimes millennia. A climax forest can exist. But at some point, something happens. Climate change might happen. And a little beetle that used to die off every winter now lives through the winter, and more of them survive. And the beetles start eating the trees, and the trees begin to die. The temperature might change, and new diseases and pathogens come and start killing the trees. Climate change might result in more vicious storms that produce more lightning that cause fires, and the trees burn down. Now look, remember, maybe it's good, maybe it's not. I love forests. I love forests. I think forests are one of the most, like if an alien came to the earth, London and New York might be interesting, but forests would really blow their mind. And forests are so amazing. But you know, forests are a conservation phase. And when forests burn or die, all of the wealth, the resources of energy and wealth that are stored in those tall trees are burned to the ground. And within weeks or months, new green shoots up and species that haven't been seen for centuries show up. And a new cycle begins. Is the exploitation phase good? Yes. Is the conservation phase good? Yes. But good and bad aren't good enough words. It's part of a phase. And then, so that conservation phase leads to what we might call collapse or decline or unraveling. The word in life sciences, in the adaptive cycle, they call it the release phase. When the regime, the organization of things begins to release and let things, and things are dissipated. And so that brings us to that sort of bottom part of the story. But then once things, you understand now, a whole bunch of energy has been released. And now new things become possible. And so that last phase, they call the reorganization phase. And that's where new possibilities begin to emerge. New things start to happen that we hadn't imagined before. And then something new becomes possible. And what happens, the new thing that happens, is not just a repeat of the old thing, because the old thing changed the conditions that exist for the new thing. Just to give you a very specific example. When a forest reaches its climax forest stage, conservation stage, over thousands of years, it produces sometimes many meters of topsoil that didn't exist when the forest began. It's created topsoil. And so after the fire or whatever happens, now the new situation has new soil to begin with, and it will be a whole new reality that comes. Now, when you think about that process of exploitation, conservation, release, and reorganization, you can't just say, oh, this is the good phase. This is the phase I like. Thinking only in terms of good and bad, it will keep you from facing the larger reality. And this made me ask a question in the process of writing this book. What phase of a global civilization do I think that we're in? I tend to think that this global civilization has developed over the last 150 years or so. It's slowly evolved as different local civilizations, regional civilizations shared their technologies, shared their insight, shared their science, and built economies and connected their economies, and we created this global civilization. Is it good? Is it bad? Those aren't helpful terms. It has very good things. It has very bad things. For some people, one thing is good. For another people, that's terrible. I'm just thinking about this being here in England. And I was just reading a historic marker about how, you know, in a certain part of your history, people started having looms to weave cloth. And there was what we often call cottage industries. And I would guess that a lot of your great grandparents, or maybe a generation or two earlier, had home looms. And they would have been in terrible poverty if they hadn't been able to have looms and take the cotton, which was being grown in the United States by slave labor and shipped over here. And people were making money every bit along the way. But that created a way for people to make a living and to survive and to build families. And you wouldn't be here if that hadn't existed. To say, was it good or bad? Well, guess what? Pretty soon, those individual looms went out of business. And then larger factory looms were used. And your ancestors went out of business. And you'd say, well, isn't that terrible? Yeah, it was terrible for them. But there are bigger things going on here. Well, one last thing I should say, and then I'd like to turn to talk about how new worlds are born, how the reorganization phase leads to the possibilities of new birth and of new possibilities. Very often when civilizations decline, they don't know they're declining. The Roman Empire, it took centuries for the Roman Empire to fall. You know the old saying, Rome wasn't built in a day? It didn't fall in a day either. We might talk about the invasion of Alaric or some specific event, but there was a stair-stepping feature to it. They couldn't solve problems, things got a little worse. They couldn't solve problems, things got a little worse. I don't think, by the way, there was a particular moment when the Roman Senate Rome was being invaded and the Roman Senate all left town to save their lives, and they never came back. and that may have been the end, you know. And they had to go to the Pope and say, hey, would you kind of run the empire for us while we're figuring out what to do here? But people could have lived for centuries and be part of that decline phase, that release phase, and not even have known it. They would just think, yeah, we can't get soldiers like we used to, or we haven't had a good prime minister in a long time, you know, that kind of a thing. But I ask myself, where do I think we are? Where are our lives being lived out? And I went through this imagination process that if we are coming to the end of the conservation phase, and we might be in for a time when there's going to have to be a radical reorganization of our civilization, will we be able to do it without a collapse? In other words, will we be able to slowly turn the ship in a very new direction? That's the only real piece of news every day. All the stuff they put on TV and radio and the internet, there's lots of stories, but the big story is, are we going to do this in a concerted, coordinated, reasonable, sane way? Or is it going to be subverted by authoritarians and by billionaires who just want to make a few more million or billion euros or dollars or rubles on fossil fuels at our expense and our children's expense? And they're too idiotic and selfish and greedy and foolish to realize that their way of make, they've made enough money that way and they should go do something else, right? That's the story that we wake up with every day. And I ask myself, if I'd been born during the exploitation phase, in my country, the exploitation phase was when people from this country and other European countries came over and said, there's a lot of land we can exploit. We just have to steal it from the native peoples and get them out of the way. There's a lot of labor we could exploit. We just have to import it and pack people like sardines in a tin in ships and ship them over from Africa. But guess what? They exploited it. And I want to tell you something. The Christian religion helped them do it. Yes, there were a few abolitionists, but most of the preachers were giving sermons to help people feel good about what they were doing and to thank God for this wonderful exploitation phase. And I would not exist if people hadn't survived through all that. And is it good? Is it bad? It's a mess. It's a moral mix. And now I find myself looking back and thinking, I'm kind of glad I wasn't born during those times. If I'd been born at the early conservation phase, when everything was about holding on, I think that's when I was born. In many ways, the battles of the 20th century, the world wars of the 20th century, were trying to hold on and keep this thing going, this global capitalistic economy going. And the Cold War was this sort of try to maintain. And in a sense, I was born during those years. And those years formed many people, but I became suspicious of that whole project, and I never lived easily with it. And I wonder now, if I'm living this part of my life, and all of you who are younger, you have the vast part of your life at this time of transition when the old can no longer be sustained and something new must be born. And will it be born smoothly and wisely and quickly, or stupidly and slowly and without any sense of collaboration among our species? And we don't have the power to control that outcome, but we do have the power to say, how do we want to show up in this time? To live in this time when a new world must be born. When new worlds are born, it seems to me, when you look back in history, it involved people having imagination that they never would have had if they were making a lot of money and having a lot of fun in the exploitation and conservation phases. It's usually the people who are experiencing the downside of the current regime who begin to dream, I wonder if another world is possible. I wonder if there's another arrangement that could possibly exist. It often requires falling down a stair and falling down another stair and falling down another stair until you say, I don't think we're going to get back the good old days. We have to imagine something different. The way I shaped the book when I wrote it was around this process, a process of letting go of your illusions, letting go of your sense that our current way of life is the only way of life, then letting be. Letting things settle, realizing if we rush to think we can solve the problem with our old way of thinking, we'll bring our old way of thinking along, which will subvert our solution to our problems. Letting be, to let a new way of thinking and seeing and imagining arise in us in the time that it takes to arise in us. You know when you're letting go, when you feel some anxiety and some pain and some depression, all the components of the experience of grief, anger, denial, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. All of that happens in that letting go phase. You know you're in the letting be phase when these words keep coming out of your mouth unexpectedly. I don't know. I don't know what to do about that. I don't know what will happen. I don't know if that's good or if it's not. I don't know. The American sage and farmer poet Wendell Berry says, it's when we admit that we don't know that our work really begins. He says, only the impeded stream sings. And what I've experienced in myself is, to the degree I can live in unknowing, in uncertainty, and I've let go of the old rules of the game. I don't even know what the new game is. And I am willing to live in that liminality or uncertainty, that I find every once in a while a little glimmer, an idea. Can I tell you, I think it's why so many of us are drawn to poetry at these times. Because poetry is intentionally slowing us down and inviting us into new ways of seeing, rather than just keeping the old narratives going. And in that letting be phase, a new seeing comes, a new imagining comes, and that's the third phase, letting come. And we begin to welcome new possibilities. Here's what I found. It's happening around the world. If you talk to some of our smartest people in the world, here's what they're saying. We need to rediscover indigenous wisdom. Now, part of that could just be a fad. But part of it is deep wisdom to say, we have all been so brainwashed. Our brains have been so shaped by capitalism and civilization and progress and the idea that competition and violence are inevitably part of the human being. All of these ideas are so deeply embedded in us. We need to find some people who've resisted these ways of thinking and might have alternative ways of thinking for us. People who lived closer to the land, people who understood not that the land belonged to them, that's the way the colonizers think, but people who believe they belong to the land and are part of the land. And I find myself being curious to learn from people that I wasn't paying attention to before. And it's not that we should put the burden on anyone else to have a solution to all of our problems, but that suddenly we realize we need to learn from one another. Can I tell you, among people of leaders of different religions who've realized that we're in this shift, and they don't think their old religions and their old ways of thinking are the way forward, when we get together, rabbis and imams and leaders of Sikh communities and Hindus, and when we get together, we're all in this situation, we no longer think we alone have the answers. We bring our treasures to each other, and the value of the treasures we bring, that's part of the letting come. Let the resources come that were never shared before for new possibilities to emerge. And one of the things that happens in that process is that we discover treasures in our own tradition. And I'd like to just tell you in closing, what's happened to me as I've gone through this process, letting go, letting be, letting come, and then being set free to do our part, to show up, to turn up in the ways that we can in this time that we have. Where we are part of something that's bigger than any of us, and we don't know what the future holds, but we've become clear on how we want to turn up. I started to realize something that was true all along, and I'd never seen it. Our Bible, we have these two parts, and the first part is the Hebrew Scriptures. We tried to denigrate it by calling it the Old Testament, as if we'd move way beyond that. Did you ever notice who are the main figures in the Hebrew Scriptures? They're called the 12 tribes of Israel. The word tribe, of course, evokes indigenous people who were deeply bonded to their land. When things went wrong, they didn't just think they could move somewhere else. They were bonded to their land, the land of their ancestors. They identified themselves by their ancestry and their connection to the land. And they had a set of values, values that weren't measured by money, values, in fact, that were willing, at least in theory, to say, you know, our relations are more important. Our well-being is more important than how much money we have. So we're willing to reorganize our economics every 7 years and every 49 years so that we, because there are more important things than money. These were indigenous people, and when they were overwhelmed and overcome by other people, they didn't dream, we're going to become a bigger empire and kill all of them someday. Maybe somebody dreamed that, but most of them, their primary dream is, we just want to be people living in harmony with the land and in harmony with each other and in harmony with our neighbors. That's our dream. And I suddenly started to think of Jesus as an indigenous prophet at a critical moment when his people were being tempted to sell out their indigenous values to accept the values of the Roman Empire. And when I heard in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus say, don't be like those Gentiles. Don't be like those colonizers. Don't be like those people building an unsustainable and unjust civilization. But instead, be like the birds of the air and the flowers of the field. Re-indigenize. Become an ecological people again. Discover the real universe that we live in. And when he looked for words to describe this new vision, because whenever you have a new vision in that release phase, when you're imagining a rebirth phase, you have to find imagery that will make sense to the people you're speaking to. He uses the image, the kingdom, the empire, the civilization of God, a new civilization that is so different from this civilization that we have to begin to imagine and dream of now. And so, my dear brothers, sisters, friends, neighbors, at this time, gatherings like Greenbelt become so important. Because it's in these autonomous zones, in these special places where we disrupt our lives and are willing to sit in the rain for an hour. And where we spend our days outdoors and let ourselves be re-influenced by the cycles of this earth. And we remind ourselves that we are earth children and we're part of that. These trees are our tall standing brothers and that the grass beneath you is related to you. And we begin to reconnect that new imaginations become possible so that we can let go, so that we can let be, so that we can let come, and so that we can be set free. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.